getting really good at spelling Aristides these days.
Can you move the speaker over here, actually?
Hello, everyone.
Hey, Sean.
Hello.
Can you hear us, Sean?
Oh, yeah, I can hear you just fine.
Great, thanks. Well, there were no meeting rooms yesterday evening.
Mm-hmm.
I had to go to Pat's Droop on my knees.
Beg the use of this room.
Beg the use of this room. See, this is booked for the infrastructure assessment team. And the other thing is that F326, I promised that I would just give that to Rolf for his meeting today, last week,
mm-hmm.
in a weak moment.
Yeah.
And so I couldn't say, Rolf, God damn it, give me the room back. Yeah, I know I said you could have it, but never mind that.
Yeah, that room was pretty full when I walked past.
Yeah. But there's this meeting with all these from the various labs going on, administrators,
mm-hmm.
various types. They have all the rooms locked down, you know. Like the science bowl or something.
Yeah,
like
right. Science bowl is frequently annoying because they lock the rooms down not one day in advance, but 2 days in advance.
Exactly. Just make sure.
Hold deep. Yeah. Oh, there we are.
Okay, so shall we start?
Okay.
Any announcements? I thought I had an announcement. Oh, yeah. The announcement is that we're moving the collaboration email list from Dust Bunny to jlab.org. Much more dignified URL.
You used to have it on Anthrax, so Dust Bunny was a lot better.
Oh, that's true, that's true. So, at least Dust Bunny is benign. Okay,
yeah.
So the impetus is just Indiana University policy about managing your own web stuff. But anyway, we're in the process of doing that. So look for that to come. It's still kind of in test mode, but Sherman got it up really fast. That's an announcement.
Once you get it there, then I have to do some configurations for email servers as well. So
Right. So, I mean, the tricky part is doing a transition such that we don't lose the archive. The archive, we were able to transfer the archive, so the archive is fully there. But that's not really for this meeting, but it's an announcement. The other announcement is kind of a rumor, but there's a rumor. So please don't pass this around, and I'm not going to put it in the thing, but it's pretty benign, actually, but there's a rumor that Department of Energy doesn't want to support, or ESnet, Department of Energy doesn't want to have ESnet paying for video conferencing. Has anyone heard this?
No.
And so the ESnet video conferencing may disappear. That's the rumor I heard.
So this Google is coming up with something too that's pretty good. There's a lot of things we can investigate. Probably different. The last time we looked at this was 2 years ago or so.
Okay, but the lab is looking at an alternate solution. Okay, is that Volker at FSU?
Yeah.
Got it. Sorry, I'm late.
No, well, okay. We'll only give you one demerit then, since you apologize.
Maybe next week when I'm at the lab, if I run into Roy Whitney, I'll ask him if he knows anything.
Okay, that'd be good probably. And then at JLab we have myself, Simon who's off camera, and Chris Larue.
Chris Larue.
Chris is with Scientific Computing, and he's the lead on the workflow tool.
Okay.
And so I invited him to sit in, and he may sit in from time to time. He may get sick of us and decide never to come back, but that remains to be seen.
No, this is great because our primary goal, at least at first with the workflow, is to support Hall D, since you guys are going to be the brunt of the data crunch. It'll be good for me to really understand what you guys need going on. Because I mean, for the first phase, I mean, we will focus on Hall D's needs. I mean, ultimately, our goal is to encompass the needs of all of the lab, but you know, given that Hall D is the brunt of it right now, that'll be our priority.
Okay, so thanks for coming.
Sure.
Thanks.
Sure. But,
okay, sure. All right. All right, so I'm not going to introduce you to everybody because, well, you'll get to know us over time. Okay, so now let's go on to any other announcements. Okay, status of preparations. Bullet number one, update on phi equals zero.
This problem is resolved now. Benny checked that out, and I also checked it out. Richard checked in a fix to this problem recently. I think this is okay now.
And he wrote to the list, right, about that?
Yeah.
So everyone saw that, or should have seen that that email. So that changes to confirm. Okay, so that's great. Second bullet, random number seeds procedure. I still haven't done anything. Has anyone done anything on that? Anyone? Just me and anyone, you know, working on that.
Anyone's pretty
not
lazy.
Not making much progress. And that's actually a lot of people, you know, and still can't make any progress on this. Okay, I just haven't had it. So that stays on the list. Okay. So the issue there is our random number seeds. How do we control them? How do we use them afterwards? We record them to be able to reproduce stuff. If there's an error or something like that, or reproduce the same event. So we need to understand how we're saving them and how we get them back out and how we do the reproduction in detail. There's a mechanism undocumented right now. Okay, so let's go on. Bullet three, running jobs at CMU.
So if you remember, last week with Mark released several tags of the software that we could try to use for running jobs, and I ran a bunch of jobs here at CMU, and about a third of them were crashing. Whereas Kay, for example, was using very similar software, and he had very, very few crashes. And one of the main differences was at Indiana, Kay did not have a restriction on the memory usage, whereas we did. So what I did was, for our jobs here, I kept the same settings with the electromagnetic background in, but I allocated 2 gigs of RAM for the physical RAM for the job, which wasn't enough. So I then allocated 5 gigs of virtual memory. And adding that in, I don't know what the default was, but making that setting changed it so that I only get a 5% crash rate. And so at least with the software as of a week ago, the vast majority of the issues were memory related. So I guess Simon's been looking at that, and I'm sure he could tell us more about what might be going on. But at least it looks like it wasn't that's the main issue.
I haven't had much success tracking down these memory-related issues. I did find a couple of bugs in the tracking code that would have caused other crashes, but those seem to be relatively minor anyway, but it should be a little bit better now.
It just something's grabbing massive amounts of memory, and it spikes as you go through. Well, I don't know if it builds up during the job or if it spikes and goes away or what.
It's not easily reproducible, that's for sure. It makes it hard to.
Have we managed to run Valgrind yet to see if there are suggestions of where we could look on this or?
I have been running Valgrind. There are indications of memory problems, but they are related to the Xerxes stuff. I don't know how to debug that stuff.
Okay.
I've been executing HD root within this time command, which if you give it the proper control flags, it will tell you how much memory it used, the process used. And I'm getting numbers like 3 gigs, 5 gigs of memory on some of these, which is similar to what Kay was seeing. So something's going on.
Okay, we'll just have to keep grinding on this. I think we're definitely making progress, but. Yeah, I mean, you recall that the problems I was seeing in JLab were not all memory-related. And I don't think I get down to 5% just by eliminating the memory issues. But we'll get to that later.
Okay.
So, Paul, do you have any more? Have you been able to try the new tag?
I don't know anything about a new tag.
Mark sent an email out yesterday, was it? Or?
Yeah. It was pretty late yesterday.
I guess I missed it.
You must have been out drinking, fooling around, being lazy.
Sounds like Paul.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Anyway, okay. So, no, good. That's really good information. And you got zero memory crashes then. At 5 gig.
No, it says 5%.
Oh, 5% crash rate due to memory.
Were they due to memory or do you?
The signature is similar, and the memory usage on those was high. I don't know if that's necessarily what happened, but.
Right.
I mean, one thing you could do is try to resubmit those 5 jobs with a much bigger memory limit and see what.
Well, heck, those ones that crashed, I just ran them on Irwin and they crashed even on the command.
The crashing command line.
Yeah,
okay.
But even not in the batch system. So I got one or two that seem steadily reproducible. I don't know if Simon, if I sent you that one of those, it would help. But
Well, yeah, sure. I'll give it a look if you point me where to look. Sure.
Okay. Okay, so let's go on to Northwestern.
Okay, yeah, so I've been investigating, I guess, kind of a maybe a slightly different fail mode, because one of the things that I was trying to do is just work out the software. There's some grid things that I want to get to later on, but part of the problem we have here is that a number of our nodes are a little bit older, and so I was trying to figure out the different file sizes to see how much I could actually cache on the local disk. And so I got to the point where most of the crashes in general, it seemed that HTJAUNT running was fine, MCSMEAR was fine. All the problems that I saw came at the REST stage. And almost all the time, it was a problem when starting up the REST job. So
Starting up.
Huh.
Yeah, right in the beginning. So
that's a new one.
How many threads are you running?
It's an old one, but
yeah.
Yeah, just one thread.
Okay.
So, and it seemed really sensitive to where I was putting the files. So if I was running everything off off network disk, then inevitably it would crash. And so if I ran, if I at least created the REST files right on a local disk, then I was able to run 10K jobs, running 10K events.
Mm-hmm.
And that was fine. That gave me 5% or less crash rate. I was running some jobs with 50K over last night, and there a lot of the jobs were dying. And so I'm not sure what was going on. But so the interesting thing is that I was able to run some jobs in a debugger, so using GDB in batch mode. And so what I found is that a lot of these jobs were crashing when they were trying to load the geometry, so when they're actually parsing the XML files. And so that's when I was running the XML files. Those were sitting on a network drive. What I did is that I was putting the SQLite CCDB file and the magnetic field on a local drive. But I was loading the geometry over the network. So I copied the XML files to a local drive. Those problems went away, but I still seemed to have a lot of jobs crashing when they were trying to load at least some point in where they were accessing the magnetic field, even when I was reading from the local disk. So I don't know if it's just because some of the nodes were being overloaded, or there's still some latency going through there. So that's kind of weird. I'm still trying to puzzle that out. But for some reason, it seems to be okay when I run, 10K events at a time. With 50K events, it's not so good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're rolling the dice 5 more times,
If it's something that steadily builds up, then you're running 5 times as long too.
Right, yeah. But then, this just ran overnight, so maybe there was some other transient problem. I don't know. I mean, the problem is, when you're running 50K events, you have less turnaround time. So that's one issue. One other thing that I'm trying out is what Richard was mentioning, is that for running over the grid, they have this CVMFS, which is basically a read-only file system. That's transmitted over HTTP, and so that's kind of the way everybody is distributing their software over the grid, and so we need to do that. And so I tried to set up just kind of a local server for that here, so that I could at least test out the software and make sure that my nodes were working right. And so I've gotten to the point where that works, and so I'm going to try running the software, running my jobs here, where I'm loading the software over this CVMFS thing, and it'll be really interesting to see not just if it works, but to see if I see some of these latency problems there as well.
Have you installed SRM at Northwestern?
Yeah.
And was that, sounds like it wasn't such a big deal.
You mean setting up the SRM?
Yeah, the way you said yeah, you know, it's like, no problem.
In terms of setting the grid up, actually setting up the CE was really easy.
Setting up the what? Sorry.
So they have two different parts, right? The computing element, which is kind of the interface to the batch system.
Okay.
That was really easy, but setting up the storage element took a while. But that's mainly because you have more moving parts there. You know, not only do you have the SRM interface, you also have to have some storage system that it interfaces to.
Yes.
And so that took me a little bit to work out. But it actually all works out now, so I'm happy.
You're gonna tell us about this next week at the collaboration meeting too. You have a talk scheduled.
Ah, true. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So I'll put something there, and then afterwards, certainly feel free to ask me any questions. Maybe I'll need to put a wiki page together or something.
Maybe we can have you come to Pittsburgh and set ours up.
sure, why not?
Okay, great. Anything else, Sean?
No, that's all I have right now.
Okay, so let's go on to EM background then.
Is he just in the
cell? Yeah. So I just added a quick. Yeah, I'm on ESnet, so you can't see me, but I'm here.
Check your refresh your agenda, Mark. I think there's an item.
I just added a one about running jobs in this MIT OpenStack cluster.
Okay.
Real brief, I just ran 100 test jobs last night with 10,000 events each without E&M background, so, less of a stress test than what Paul was talking about, and got, 2% failure rate. Didn't have any of the memory issues that have been talked about so far. That could be because I'm not using the E&M background, but it's also the way the jobs are structured is a little bit different since they're running on this virtual machine. You're running 8 processes on this virtual machine, and they sort of share their memory. So I don't know if that may be an impact on why I'm not seeing the memory problem. But basically, I just had these 2 failures where the just had a crash on this tracking in the Kalamazoo routine. But I haven't looked deeper into what that was exactly.
How recent is your code? Go ahead.
This is the one that Mark tagged a week ago.
Okay. I may have fixed the issues that led to those 2 failures. Maybe.
Okay. All right, so I guess I can recheck out Mark's new tag for Data Challenge 2, and I'll have those fixes?
Well, that's the hope, I suppose.
You better double-check that. Maybe somebody can check that and then email everyone.
I got to put my talk farther up on the agenda. This is.
You feel deprived, Mark.
I have something to say about all of these things. And
you're running.
Anyway, go ahead.
Talk.
Okay, so.
All right, that's all I had.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Justin. That's real progress. That's a huge amount. I mean, you got the whole software stack running. What operating system are you running virtually?
It's Scientific Linux 6.
Scientific Linux 6, you said, is that right?
Yeah.
Is that what he said? Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay, so let's go down to the last bullet and click on that little tiny link that says JLab.
Yeah.
Doesn't work here.
Oh, there we go.
Okay, so, and then if you remember, the versions are posted under the February 7th version section. There's a link there that shows the version page. The version page hasn't really. Okay, so the point is that this branch of SimRecon has been updated. Okay, so that has now the latest code, except for the time of flight, which is still back in before recent changes. Okay, so that being the case, the HDDS should not be updated because that HDDS contains changes to the time of flight. So to be consistent, you need to update SimRecon and not update HDDS on these branches. I mean, the branch, the HDDS branch itself has not been changed, so that's a good, that's still a good tag. If you update it, nothing will happen. Okay. Just the root has gone beyond a consistent set of geometries for this data challenge software stack. So, so I did that sort of late yesterday afternoon, made that update, and in the email I mentioned I also tagged the version that we had before so that we could go back to that if that turns out to be interesting. Okay, so that's the Data Challenge 2 conditions page. Now, if you go to back to the quick look at DC2 page, there's another addition for dated today. So last night I ran the same types of jobs, 50,000 events per job. Only this time the memory requests I doubled to 3 gigabytes. I got 400 jobs through, and success rate was a lot better. If we go at this rate, then we'll be done in another week, I guess, you know.
So the major failure was the SIMD fit thing.
Right. That seems to be the major one. And we got a new one for wall time, killed for wall time. Now, that, it's conceivable, I'm not quite sure whether it was new and never occurred a week ago, or whether I just wasn't checking a week, didn't check closely enough for all possible cases out of 1,000 files, you know. So I don't know the answer to that question, whether we had wall time issues last week. But we certainly have some this time. I forgot to put this down. The time request in both cases was 15 hours. So I'm blowing 15 hours. I looked at one of the jobs that ran this week, and it took 9 hours to finish. So this is sort of a factor of two cushion. Well, not quite, but quite a good cushion on CPU time.
These have electromagnetic background in them?
These still do not have electromagnetic background.
Okay.
I mean, until we can get this to run clean, it seems I'm not really that motivated.
No, that's fine. I just wanted to know where we were with that here.
Sure, absolutely. And that's the issue. This entire stack trace error didn't occur at all. Remember, it's a smaller number of jobs than last time. So it looks like, and there's a whole lot of stuff that got updated here, because last time it was held back to the pre-time of flight era.
Right.
Pre-time of flight change era, which goes back a bit. And so there was a lot of changes going from the February 7th to the February 14th version of this branch.
Okay, so I can look at the log file to see what that fitter error is.
The line number was different than this, but the code has changed also. So.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily significant. Okay, so that's part of the background. But this also says that errors are not due just to this memory issue. But going from 1.5 to 3 gigs makes a big difference. Okay, which says something. Oh, it does not add up. By the way, it does not quite add up.
So what are the other failures?
I'm off by one.
What?
Yeah. I think some of these are redundant.
But it does feel like we do have, I mean, the amount of memory some of these jobs need just seems to suggest there's something wrong somewhere.
Yeah,
and then I was talking to Sandy yesterday. She says that generally on the farm, 2 gigabytes is pretty big, I mean, as these things go. And so, you know, if we're unusual in the size of our memory footprint, then that makes it, that might cause some bottlenecks on the farm down the road, you know, because they're optimizing everything for smaller jobs, right? That's kind of a weak...
This just feels like there's something going wrong in the code somewhere that's really subtle, and we just need to figure out what it is.
Yeah, I agree. How's it better?
What's like 3 gig for on your bands?
I think I agree. This single threaded.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So I it looks like we really should go on to this new tag though. It seems to help things, and also the information that Paul reported about allowing for more memory. But hopefully, if we figure this out, we can get by with less memory. You know, it may also be
somebody disconnected. It went crazy. I think it's Kay on some second video system.
Sorry, my mic wasn't working, so I'll mute now.
Okay.
You know, it could
we have Kay from two different camera angles.
Still on the screen here. Smile, Kay.
Time for your close-up, Dr. Moria. Okay, that's a very old reference. Only Curtis laughed. Anyway, so, what I was going to say is, it may be that, you know, I was talking to Simon, this is kind of an obvious point, but it may be that there's, every so often you run across an event which just blows up, you know. And what we have to do is just recognize that and kill the event. It's likely, in that case, unreconstructable anyway. And that if we do that in an intelligent way, then we might be able to get away with less. Because I mean, the batch system here certainly will die if you just spike on a single event. I mean, it will fill you out memory-wise.
Yeah, really. I mean, we can set up to run here, but you don't get you start wasting CPUs on the folder here.
Okay, so that's one thing. The other thing that I wanted to mention that I don't have on the slide is that I've gone to I'm using another mode to launch these jobs where I'm launching. Well, last week I launched a bunch of 1,000 event jobs with the February 7th, but the February 14th I launched a bunch of 500 event jobs. So the idea is, I did 10,000 last weekend, and I did, I think, 3,000 or 4,000 last night, small ones. And the idea is that, and actually a lot of them go through, you know, with no errors.
Well,
that's good to know. Anyway, so a much higher percentage, which is what you expect, of course. But the idea is to launch a bunch and then try to get some of them to fail so Simon can look at a smaller file.
Yep.
So it's a practical thing, and
yeah, because the problem is that these bad events could be then 15,000 out of a 50,000 event file.
So it was actually pretty easy. I just had to tweak a couple of parameters in the system, and you know, and just do more jobs of shorter duration, and that was really no work at all to do that. But Simon said that it helped him with the fixes he found during the week, right?
Yeah.
Having the shorter file.
Yeah, that was very useful.
So
just go to such a bad event.
So we'll continue to do that as a debugging tool. Sandy looked at me yesterday, why are you why are you submitting all these 8-minute jobs to the production farm? You know, it's like, what is wrong with you? But that was the goal of that. And then the other thing I wanted to mention was, I can't remember now. Oh, well, I think it'll come to me. It'll come to me. So what? Oh, well, let's go back to electromagnetic background then. Kay, do you have any updates or not?
Looks like,
or?
It looks like it's got something there.
Yeah, so I put up a link to a bunch of slides that are created. So, sorry my mic wasn't working. I was trying to say something, but I didn't know if Mark was just ignoring me or my mic wasn't working, so.
Yeah. We won't tell you.
So anyway, so going on to my slides, so on slide 2, you probably saw this figure at the bottom that shows the memory use, the maximum memory use for 10 jobs that I submitted. So one thing that I wanted to say before was that for each of the different types of runs, I've seen the time it took to process the files change by 50% or more. So, Mark, if you only have, like, you know, 50% of a cushion, then you might want to increase that a bit more.
Okay,
going on to slide 3. I may have shown this last week, but this is the number of showers that are reconstructed. So this is, I was mostly working with the shower information for the different configurations. So just to refresh everybody's mind, no EM means that no background. And 1.1 in 200 means that this is the standard configuration for 10 to the 7 photons per second with a 200 nanosecond gate. For the ENM background to leak in. So 5.5 means that there's 5 times the EM background rate, and 400 means that the gate time has been increased to 400 nanoseconds around the incoming photon time. So you can see the number of showers increases as you put in more background. So the magenta histogram is the one with the highest rate and also the longest gate time, and you can see that there's a lot more showers there. If you look at the energy deposited within the F-cal and the B-cal, the amount of energy, low energy deposited in the F-cal is a lot higher, of course, with the higher ENM rate, whereas the B-cal doesn't get any kind of substantial increase in the background. So moving on to slide 4. So this shows the shower time versus energy for the F-cal. So for each photon that comes in, I'm looking at the shower time of that photon, also the energy. So you can see for when I do put in the electromagnetic background, then there's a lot of more events, and you can see them as the bands that come in for around plus minus 200 or plus minus 400 nanoseconds. Slide 5 shows a more close-up of this. So slide 4 was from a humongous range of minus 500 to plus 500 nanoseconds. But if I look closer in time at the plot, then you can see that there's like these 2-nanosecond band structures that correspond to the CBAF machine. So every 2 nanoseconds we have some kind of background coming in, and that seems to be replicated very well within the simulation.
Jesus Christ, you put that in there?
Yes.
These are relentless.
Yeah.
Okay, and then you can see probably at the bottom plot that with the higher rate, you can see that that there is a little bit more background coming in compared to the standard one. So slide 6, these are just projections onto the X and Y axis of the plots that you were just seeing. So if I project onto the time axis, then you can see this 2-nanosecond structure very well. Then if I project onto the energy axis, then you can see that there's a lot of buildup towards the low energy. So this is all for F-cal photons. So the question for the F-cal would be, okay, so can we make a timing cut, as Richard pointed out last week, to reduce the number of photons? So starting on slide 7, I've started to look into that. So since the F-cal has a little bit of a radial spread, I wanted to see how different the incoming photon time would be as a function of the distance from the target. So I just chose the center of the target to be at 0, 0, and 65. This is just the center of the target. and I just calculated based on the reconstructed shower position what the total distance is from the target center. So you can see that there's really no difference at all in terms of the distance from the target. So even if you hit the center of the FCAL or the very edges, it's not going to make a huge difference in terms of the shower timing. So basically just see a very straight band that goes horizontal. There's probably a little bit of a slope there just because it takes more time for the photons to get there, but it's probably very negligible. So on slide 8, I made a few cuts to show how the energy of the showers changes with the timing cut. So the first plot that you see on the left is with a very loose cut. So I just chose 10 nanoseconds around the peak of the incoming photon showers. That would be on slide 6, where you can see that humongous peak there corresponding to the actual showers. So if I make a very loose 10 nanosecond cut, then that basically removes most of the electromagnetic background. So you can see that if you compare the black histogram with the magenta histogram, which has the most background in it, you can see that I've probably reduced most of the background, especially if you're looking at the region above, say, I don't know, like 1 GeV or so. I can also make this cut a lot tighter because we know that the FCAL timing resolution is on the order of like maybe half a nanosecond or so, depending on the pulse height that's coming in. But if I make a much tighter cut of like 4 nanoseconds, which would still be like a plus minus 3 sigma cut or something for the FCAL timing, then you can see that basically I can remove almost all of the background coming in for the FCAL. So for the FCAL, the increase in the electromagnetic background does not seem to be an issue.
Hey, Kay?
Yes.
Do you know, so when you're making these cuts, do you know what your signal efficiency is at all?
What do you mean by signal efficiency?
So, I mean, I'm just wondering if you're losing, when you're making these cuts, how many non-EM background cut events or showers that you're losing. Just because, like, when I compare the two plots, it looks like the vertical scale is a lot different. Or is that just because why in one case it's logarithmic, in one case it's linear?
I don't think I'm losing too much because if you compare the no electromagnetic background, then you can probably see that, well, I guess, yeah, so to look at that, you can probably look at slide 4 or something where you can see the overall structure of timing versus energy. And you can see there that basically all of the actual showers come in at, you know, this about 20 nanoseconds, and then everything else is all of this hadronic junk or whatever that comes in at a much later time. So I would assume that if you actually do have photons coming from the primary interaction, that those guys are just going to come in at this very sharp band around 20 nanoseconds. So I don't think I'm going to be losing a lot of my actual photon showers by making these cuts.
Okay, thanks.
Well, it's important to check that.
Yeah.
You know, that's whenever you apply any cut, you have to confirm that you're not losing any signal or quantify that loss. Anyway, so yeah, so what slide are we on again?
So I just talked about the cuts on slide 8.
Okay.
And just to convince people that there's nothing wrong with the BCAL, I have some slides on the BCAL on slide 9.
Okay.
So these sets of plots are just from the highest rate and highest, the longest gate time for the ENM background, but the plots look pretty much the same for every single configuration, so there's really no effect of the background on the BCAL. So on the bottom right plot, there's a little bit of structure there that I don't really understand. So if I plot the timing of each shower against the distance from the target, there seems to be some vertical structures there, but I don't really know what that is.
Is there a lower energy threshold on that plot?
I don't think so. So I believe that there's a default cut on the BCAL energy, so you can probably see that on slide 3. I forgot what the exact value was. But anyway, I don't think this is an issue that has to do with the background A&M background that we're trying to investigate here, so I think we can just go on.
Okay,
so
slide
besides
nine, slide.
Yeah, so starting on slide 10, so besides the shower information, I've also started to look into the generated information and also the tracking information. So slide 10 just shows the total momentum in each direction reconstructed with parent ID 0. So one of the issues we had before was that even if you do select parent ID 0, which I believe is assumed to be all of the primary particles, you would get this very broad range of this is the generated information. So you if you sum all those up, then you didn't get a very sharp peak at 0. You had a very large distribution. But what I'm seeing right now is that it seems like the code is doing a pretty good job. And out of the 2 million or so events that I ran over, if I just select all of the particles with parent ID 0 and sum all of those momenta together, it does seem that I get a very, very sharp peak at 0 for PX. And for PZ, this is what the Pythia generator is doing. So I have a coherent peak between 7.5 and 9 GV. So that seems to be okay. Slide 11, I show the generated information for P versus theta. So this is comparing the no ENM background events to the high rate elongate events. And what I've done is I've looped over the DMC thrown objects. I've just collected every single particle type, so proton, pi plus, and photon, which I'm showing here. And I don't really see any kind of difference for proton, pi plus, and also for photon. I'm sort of wondering about this. So is the ENM background, are the protons from that, are they being included in the DMC thrown? Because I don't see any kind of difference here, whereas in the previous plots you would think that there would be a humongous number of photons.
I don't think they're included. I mean, I wouldn't expect them to be included.
Okay, so is that not an issue then? Because you would want those.
I would say it's not an issue unless someone has. Yeah, I would say it's not an issue. I don't think it belongs in there. It's conditions in the hall. It's like the weather, you know.
Right. Okay, but if I wanted to understand, is it in the reconstructed information then?
It'll be in the reconstructed information. Sure.
Well, I think if once we get Tagger reconstruction code going, maybe it would show up there.
Yeah.
But we don't have that yet, right?
I mean, in case plot C, it in the reconstruction, right? From the FCAL.
Yeah. Sure. Because the reconstruction doesn't know the difference.
You see second photon that's in the tagger that's in, then we should see it in the data stream. What's there right now is the only one that's in EMC thrown appears to be the primary that triggered our event. So it's not obvious how we want to handle that at some point.
I mean, you could think about background
events
that might end
up in an electron. It looks like pretty certain that for now it's a feature, not a bug.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so I guess if people know that it's a feature, then that's fine then. Okay, so slide 12, this is the final slide. So I started to look into the track information. So I guess the concern was that for the CDC, we may have a lot very high increase in the number of tracks reconstructed because the background photons convert within the CDC. But what I'm seeing so far is that I don't see any kind of really difference in the track information. So what I did was I just grabbed all of the decharge track hypothesis objects from each event. And if I plot the number of tracks, number of those, that's the top left plot, and you can see that there's not too much of a difference between the different data sets.
I would have actually expected it to be in the FCAL or the FDC rather than the CDC, but it just looks very good.
Yeah. And then for the plus on the right, you can see the number of all the proton track candidates. So I make a selection on the track hypothesis and make sure that it's a proton. And if I do that, then you can see that the number of proton track candidates does not change with electromagnetic background. And the bottom plot is if I make a confidence level cut of 10 to the minus 3 on the tracking chi-square for that candidate, I still don't see any kind of difference, really, for the number of proton tracks reconstructed. So one thing to note about these plots is that they're not exactly an apples-to-apples comparison, because depending on the data set, I could have had maybe one run fail, whereas in another I could have had like 8 run fails. So you have to take into account like maybe like an 8% systematic difference. But even with that into account, I don't really see too much of a difference right there. The plot on the bottom left shows the number of degrees of freedom for each track that's reconstructed, and also with the chi-square cut on the tracking. You can also see there that there's not like a huge increase in the NDF of that track. So even for what we would probably call a good track, I don't see that there's like a lot more hits for the charge track hypotheses.
Mm-hmm. Do you have
okay, well,
any plots of
very
lower level?
That.
That's good news.
Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah, so
okay.
I guess Curtis was the one worried about this last week, but I wasn't really sure what kind of variables to look at besides this.
No, this looks great. I think this, the first order, this looks like we're the software is fully capable of handling the electromagnetic background.
I do recall that Paul was looking at the HD program, and he saw a lot more stuff in there, but somehow maybe it's the pruning, maybe it's something else, but it's not really being put into the final tracking information.
You get a lot of hits. You could get a lot of hits from the electrons and positrons generated by this electromagnetic background near the beam pipe in the FDC, and maybe a little bit in the first layer of the CDC. But they're probably not associated. They don't wind up getting associated with anything because they're just random hits.
I mean, to really see the effect, you might try looking. Cutting only on tracks with very low polar angle,
under 5 degrees, or something.
That mm-hmm. that might amplify whatever effect there is.
Mm-hmm.
Allow you to see it.
Yeah, that might
but
be good.
I don't know about the rest files, but could we maybe make some plots of just the raw number of hits in like the FDC, just to see that that's actually scaling like we would expect it to?
Yeah, that would be useful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a good idea. So just hit multiplicity, Kay. And, yeah. That would be interesting.
It must go up at some point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, anything else, Kay? Kay, you still with us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Just fine. Thank you.
Close the door.
Any
other questions? Is there a party in Pittsburgh going on there? Or?
There's doing a lab tour right next door.
Okay. If there are no more questions on this, that's really it's really nice work. It's really good to have some indication of how the background shows up in our data with the current software.
Yeah.
So
very
that's important. Okay. Event genealogy. Kay kind of touched on this in the middle of the last presentation. Any amplification, Kay, you want to comment on? Or?
So I think the generated total momentum seems to be very good now. So I think it's a lot better than what I saw a few months ago. The thing that I still haven't looked into is can we really uniquely identify all of the different decays? So, for example, before I was having trouble with, like, for example, events with multiple eta's or eta primes in them, because they usually tend to decay at like three different particles, and it becomes difficult if the genealogy isn't working well. I haven't been able to look into that yet, but hopefully I can look into that soon. Where
okay.
soon is probably a few weeks from now because,
Yeah, that'd be great if you could take a look. I that should be working, but, you know, someone else has to check.
Yeah, and
okay,
I think
good.
Maybe the events that were leaking out from the peak that you saw in the total four momentum.
Ah, good. Yeah, what are those?
Those may be the problem of, like, eta's decaying near the edges of the detector and some of the particles bouncing out or something. Maybe we discussed this with Benny before.
Oh, yeah.
So, but even if that's the case, the number of particles is really tiny. It's probably, like, several hundred at most compared to the 2 million in the peak. So I think it's pretty good now.
Right. Okay, I got you. That's probably what they are. I think that's right. But we should confirm that. Okay. Very good. So let's go on to, preparations of standard distribution scripts. I think that's, I don't know that there's a discussion there. Report on data management practices. Sean, do you have an update or?
No, I hadn't done anything else, so I'll, I don't know. I thought that we were maybe going to boot this issue down the road, perhaps.
Yeah, I think so. I wasn't sure. Yeah. I don't think that we asked for a follow-up even, you know, last time.
So I guess the one thing that I guess I should mention then is that for all the different sites, you know, I mean, I know that we've talked about this whole issue of SRM at JLab, but, you know, at least, you know, all the sites that are participating in this should be able to upload the files that they make, you know, to one of the SRM servers eventually. So, I mean, I'm guessing that you can at CMU, and so I don't know what Justin is applying in terms of grid tools, but, you know, I mean, I think that if you at least set up an SRM client, then that should be enough.
Yeah, I've tested uploading stuff from SRM and MIT, and it seems to work fine.
Okay, yeah. So then just as long as we can get all the files in the end, that's the important thing.
So, Justin, what did you do in particular? Can you just say you copied files from where to where
under MIT we have,
control?
Yeah, so the Tier 2 grid cluster that's mainly for CMS here has their own SRM install from the client side. And so I just used their install and ran the SRM CP command, which basically just, you know, it's like SCP, but just through SRM instead. And it just puts it on, you can put stuff on Richard's disks at UConn if you know the right, path to get there.
Okay.
And you have the grid certificate that allows you to put it there.
Right. So you went from MIT to Connecticut.
Yeah, for this, the tutorial we did over the summer, all the data was generated in MIT and sits on the UConn disk, so anyone can get it on SRM.
Got you. Okay, that's interesting. Okay, I think that brings us to the end of the agenda. The schedule is holding, such as it is. Since no one's proposed, we change it. Okay, so anything else for today? There was an issue that we did. Oh, now I know what that issue was. Go ahead.
Do we want to add the recent changes to the time-of-flight geometry to this mix?
Oh, yeah. We would like to put that in as soon as it's ready. And, you know, so we can test it.
It's
yeah.
ready to test now.
Okay. So I can add that. I can add that. I'll add that soon. Okay. The other thing is there was a – I remember the item that I had forgotten earlier. That is, there was a big discussion on email about the utility of adding electromagnetic background, even though it's going to cost us in CPU time. And I was wondering if people had comments or positions. We don't have Richard to advocate for his position, but it's certainly true that we have to do some level of electromagnetic background. I think there's really a question of whether we want to do the whole schmear with realistic levels of background.
We can also push that discussion off until the collaboration meeting next week. When we talk about data challenges, I think we'll get more opinions there. But certainly a major fraction of this has to be done with EM background, even though we know it's going to cost us with CPU.
Okay. The chair likes that idea, so we'll talk about that next week. Next week is a collaboration meeting, so I assume we're not going to have a data challenge meeting next Friday. I think we probably should meet a week after that, though, especially since we're supposed to have started by then.
We're supposed to have started
by then. We'll be running production jobs by then.
But I think we've exhausted the topics for today, in my whole opinion. Does anyone else have anything else they want to talk about, bring up? Okay, good. So let's call that done. We're adjourned. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you. Please stand by.